Hello and welcome. Nothing better shows the depths to which American political life has fallen in recent years and the lack of principle in our public discourse than the craven, ignorant, and unprincipled behavior of leading Republican presidential candidates when they recently addressed a large meeting of wealthy and influential Jews organized by something called the Republican Jewish Coalition. Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney, the leading Republican candidates currently for the nomination, addressed the forum along with others. The one Republican candidate for the presidency that was not there was Ron Paul. Ron Paul has taken a stand consistent with his views over the years against any special relationship or entangling alliance with any foreign country, and for that reason was not invited to the forum. In fact, Ron Paul's views are consistent with those that conservatives and Republicans used to hold, but no longer. Ron Paul's views are now considered, in the words of the executive director of the Republican Jewish Coalition, quote, misguided and extreme, and so far outside the mainstream of the Republican Party that he's no longer permitted to address that assembly. The craven way and pandering way that the Republican leaders who did address that assembly spoke was so blatant and obvious that it attracted considerable attention, not only across the United States, but in foreign countries as well. One of those who wrote about this event was David Weigel, who writes for Slate, an online periodical. In an article entitled Chosen People, Republican Candidates Fight It Out Over Who's Good for the Jews, David Weigel wrote of the way in which the candidates addressed the meeting. The plan, he wrote, for every candidate was nearly identical. Find the sharpest adjectives to stab into Barack Obama, promise the moon to the government of Israel, agree that Iran was an existential threat, and explain, or actually just sort of muse about, the struggle it would take to defeat them, meaning Barack Obama in the campaign and Iran in some other way. One interesting aspect of the way in which these candidates address this assembly was the way they talked about history. They, one after another, they spoke about Barack Obama's supposed policy of appeasement of Israel's enemies, and particularly of Iran, and effectively compared Israel's enemies to Hitler and invoked the most common and popular narrative of modern history, the good guy, bad guy narrative of World War II and of Europe during the 1930s and 40s. The number one morality play or lesson of history that Americans are taught and told over and over, and which is virtually an obligatory one in our society, is that everybody should be on the lookout all the time for a new Hitler, and that no one should ever do anything that's going to permit another Hitler to arise, and that whenever anyone does come up who is like that, then he should be opposed quickly and decisively. And now, of course, Iran is considered to be like Hitler and Third Reich Germany, and therefore anybody who is doing anything less than going to war against such a country is guilty of the great sin, as they see it, of so-called appeasement. Well, as I've gone into in other broadcasts and in numerous writings, this narrative, which is an obligatory one in our society, is not only superficial, simplistic, it's also simply wrong for many reasons. World War II was not a simple conflict between good and evil, and those who talk about that are showing the extent to which they accept a narrative of history that's based entirely on an outline or on premises of, in terms of what a country means or what a policy means in terms of what's good for the Jewish community in America and the world. But that's the narrative that was brought up over and over in the course of this presentation on December 7th in Washington, D.C. It was Rick Santorum who spoke first and who invoked the dread prospect or the dread feature of so-called appeasement by the Barack Obama administration, but he was followed by others. Currently, the Republican candidate who is considered the most popular, the front runner for the Republican nomination is Newt Gingrich. Now, that may change because the popularity of these candidates has proven to be very fluid. But right at the current time, Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney are the so-called front runners. Well, Mitt Gingrich, in addressing this meeting, was so blatant, so obvious in his pandering for Jewish support that he got the attention of Jay Leno, who deadpanned in his monologue the other day that Gingrich was so blatant that he would be promising that his next wife will be Jewish. During the course of his talk, Newt Gingrich also spoke about a recent flap involving the U.S. ambassador to Belgium. I'm going to digress for a few minutes to make a point about this aspect of things. Newt Gingrich said that the U.S. ambassador to Belgium, his name is Howard Gutman, should be fired. Now, what did he do that was so terrible that Newt Gingrich and other Republicans and Zionist organizations demand that Howard Gutman be fired? What did he say? Well, during the course of a talk, Howard Gutman made the point that there is that Israeli policy toward the Palestinians has generated some hostility toward Jews in Europe and the Middle East. Now, that may seem like an obvious statement and hardly something that would merit a U.S. official being fired for. But it's a dangerous thing in our society to make a statement that simple or that obvious, because for Zionist organizations, for Jewish leaders, and for American politicians, the view is that there is no relationship between what Jews do or what Israel does and what people think about Jews and Israel. That is, what's called anti-Semitism or views that are critical or hostile to Israel or to organized Jewry supposedly have no relationship to what these what Israel or Jews do. Anti-Semitism supposedly is a virus, a disease, and it's not related to any real objective. It's not based on any real objective factors. Now, that may seem so obviously stupid that nobody could accept it, but it's an obligatory view in our society, because once someone accepts that there is some relationship between what Jews do and what people think of Jews, that is, that there might be some objective basis for what's called anti-Semitism, then Jewish behavior and Jewish activities come under scrutiny and are can be judged. So for Howard Gutman to even suggest that there's a relationship between what Israel does and anti-Semitism is opens a door. It sets a dangerous precedent, and that's why Newt Gingrich and some others have demanded that Howard Gutman be fired, even though he himself is Jewish and is a child of Holocaust survivors. Gingrich, during the course of his presentation, also said that the United States should explicitly reject the concept of a right of return for Palestinian refugees. He said that permitting Palestinians who have lived whose ancestors have lived for centuries in what is now Israel, permitting them to live there would be what he called a demographic disaster and mean the end of the Jewish state of Israel. Now, Gingrich, like other American politicians, insist that Israel should not only be secure, but that it should be secure as an explicitly Jewish state. That is, the United States should guarantee and should take every measure to ensure Israel's identity ethnically and culturally and religiously as a Jewish state. Now, this is a blatant double standard. The United States and American politicians make no pledge to any other country to protect or defend or uphold its religious or ethnic character. No American politician or official pledges, for example, that Ireland will remain ethnically Irish, or that Germany will remain ethnically German, or that the religious character of any country should be maintained that way. In fact, they don't, the politicians who, like Newt Gingrich, who insist that Israel should and must have a specific Jewish ethnic religious character, believe just the opposite of the United States. That in the United States, diversity and inclusiveness are great virtues. Diversity is a strength, whereas in Israel, just the opposite is the strength. That ethnic religious cohesion and identity is crucial, whereas in America and every other country, these people say, just the opposite is the case. Newt Gingrich also announced that as president, he would appoint John Bolton to be his Secretary of State. Well, John Bolton, who when he was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, was so abrasive and so unpopular that it's simply astonishing that somebody of that nature and character should be even considered as any kind of policymaker for U.S. foreign interests. It's a little bit like saying that the Grinch should be handing out presents at Christmas time. Gingrich also emphasized in a recent interview that whereas the Jewish people, as he put it, have a right to a state, he said that Palestinians, he suggested, do not. He disputed that Palestinians are even a people. He called them an invented people. And he said that, or suggested that Palestinians have no right whatsoever because they don't even have an identity. Well, again, this is astonishing, and I'll get into some implications of that also in a moment. Former Governor Mitt Romney, former Governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, during his presentation to this forum, said that he strongly supports the so-called security wall that divides Israel from the West Bank. Now, this so-called security wall, in fact, has been already found to be illegal under international law because it's built on land that's illegally occupied by Israel. Now, that's not just merely the view of the World Court and of most countries around the world, nearly all the countries around the world, but according to Security Council Resolution 242, that the United States has for decades supported. Romney, on other occasions, has said that Barack Obama has, quote, thrown Israel under the bus. And he promised that as president, his first foreign visit as president would be a trip to Israel. He said that I'll travel to Israel on my first foreign trip. I will reaffirm as a vital national interest Israel's existence as a Jewish state. I want the world to know that the bonds between Israel and the United States are unshakable. Once again, in this case as well, Mitt Romney is upholding a standard for identity and security for Israel that it does not uphold for any other country, including his own country, the United States of America. Romney also claimed that Barack Obama has proposed that Israel adopt indefensible borders, and that means supporting a final settlement based on the 1967 borders. Well, as I will emphasize later on in this broadcast, this is an absurd position and shows that Romney, along with the other Republican candidates for the presidency, are taking a position that's inconsistent with that of longstanding U.S. policy and international law. Now, this notion that Newt Gingrich said that Israel, that the Palestinians are an invented nation, is pretty astonishing when one has any kind of historical consciousness or awareness whatsoever. It's more accurate to say that Israel is an invented nation. The modern Zionist movement, that is the movement for a Jewish state in Palestine, did not even really begin as a serious effort until the end of the 19th century. There was no concept of a specific Israeli state until the very day that Israel was proclaimed as a state. The State of Israel was proclaimed in May of 1948. Up until that very day, there was considerable debate, discussion, and confusion about what the name of this country even would be. The first postage stamps issued by Israel did not have the name Israel on them. They had the name Hebrew Post, because there was no consensus about what the name of this country even would be. In the statement issued by President Truman recognizing the new state of Israel, the word Jewish state was crossed out, and the word State of Israel was handwritten in, because, again, there was no notion up until the very last minute of what the nation, of what the country's name would even be. If there's any country that could be called invented, it's the United States of America. Up until a few years before the U.S. Declaration of Independence, there was no consensus at all about the name or even the character of a country called the United States of America. But more importantly than that, a Palestinian demand for a self-determination and a country of their own, a state of their own, has been a demand and a movement that's been going on for many, many decades and has support from the overwhelming majority of the population, a Palestinian population, and from around the world. And it's consistent with longstanding U.S. policy. More than that, whatever the historical precedent may be or may not be for a given state, that's irrelevant, really, in modern terms. Just recently, a few months ago, the independence of a new Republic of South Sudan was declared. Well, South Sudan has never existed in history as a state before a few months ago. But nobody says that because there had never been a South Sudan state in the past, it has no right to exist. Up until 1991, Slovenia had never been an independent country. But now the Republic of Slovenia is recognized and accepted around the world, even though a specific Slovene consciousness or state consciousness had not existed until fairly recently in history. The same applies to Bosnia-Herzegovina, Kosovo, or Kyrgyzstan, and many other countries that exist around the world and are accepted as such. But the support and the movement for a Palestinian state is an obvious one, and for Newt Gingrich to suggest that Palestinians aren't real or that they don't deserve a state and that Israel has a right to grab and hold on to territory from people who have lived there or whose ancestors have lived there for centuries shows either ignorance or just another example of obvious pandering to become president of the United States. Governor Rick Perry of Texas also addressed this forum, and he dismissed any negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians based on the 1967 borders and announced, like many others have, his blank check support for Israel to build settlements on the occupied West Bank territory as much as they please. In fact, not long ago, Rick Perry addressed a meeting and was so blatant in his support for Israel that the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz remarked, quote, "Except for the fact that the proceedings were held in English, an Israeli attending Texas Governor Rick Perry's press conference at the W Hotel in Midtown Manhattan Tuesday morning might be excused for imagining that he was in the middle of a pep rally for one of Israel's right-wing politicians, and a hardliner at that. Rick Santorum, who, as I mentioned, addressed this assembly, said, "The United States," I didn't say Israel, "the United States will stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, period," he said. In effect, he was committing the United States to a first strike against Iranian nuclear facilities, in effect, a declaration of war. Those people who listen to this kind of rhetoric should not be surprised if Nick Santorum or other presidents who talk this way get the United States involved in another catastrophic war that will have disastrous consequences for the United States and for the world, as knowledgeable people about U.S. foreign policy and about the world have been warning for many, many years. And of course, also addressing this meeting was Michelle Bachmann, who emphasized that her support of Israel is based, what she thinks, on her Christian principles. Well, this again is astonishing because Michelle Bachmann, in doing so, shows either her own ignorance of or betrayal of authentic Christian principles. After all, some of the population of Israel or Palestine, or living under Israeli occupation, is Christian. They're discriminated against every bit as much as the Muslims who live under Israeli occupation. In fact, the Palestinian Christians who live in what is now Bethlehem or the West Bank are people whose ancestors were among the very first people to become followers of Jesus after his death or even during his lifetime. But Michelle Bachmann believes in betraying those people and also is out of touch with the view of Christians, the vast majority of Christians around the world, in Europe, in South America, Eastern Europe, Russia, and so forth, and represents not a specifically Christian point of view, but one that is held only by certain Christians here in the United States, and of course is really a reflection, not of any Christian sensibility, but a pandering to the power and influence of the most important single religious and ethnic group in the United States, the organized Jewish community. One person who also commented on all of this was Thomas Friedman, a Jewish writer for the New York Times. And he was so put off by the blatant pandering, he warned against those who want to love Israel to death. He felt that, like others, that the pandering is so blatant and obvious that it's giving a blank check for policies by Israel that are even harmful to Israeli interests. He made the point that Mitt Romney said that I don't seek to take actions independent of what our allies think is best, and if Israel's leaders thought that a move of that nature would be helpful to their efforts, then that's something I'll be inclined to do. I don't think America should play the role of the leader of the peace process. Instead, we should stand by our ally. Well, as Thomas Friedman points out, that means, in effect, America's role is to just applaud whatever Israel does, serve as its ATM, and shut up. We have no interests of our own, and, as he comments, it's amazing that Mitt Romney is even running for president. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume in a few moments with the second half of this Mark Weber report. Hello and welcome back. When I went on break, I was citing the commentary by New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, who is himself Jewish, about the spectacle that leading Republicans made of themselves at a recent meeting in Washington, D.C. of the Republican Jewish Coalition. And he stressed that Mitt Romney in particular said, in effect, that America doesn't have any policy or shouldn't have any policy with regard to the Middle East or Israeli-Palestine conflict other than just doing whatever Israel wants. As he says, America should just be, according to Mitt Romney, the ATM for Israel, shut up and applaud whatever Israel wants, and that the U.S. has no interests of its own. Well, that's the logical consequence of the pandering view that Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, and other leading Republican and Democratic politicians have been holding for many, many years, as I'll go into in more detail. In fact, the pandering has become so obvious that some Jewish leaders have been urging U.S. politicians to be less blatant in their support for Israel, because more and more Americans can see more clearly than ever, and people around the world can understand just who's in control and just what interests are being served by these presentations. A writer for a leading Israeli newspaper, Haaretz, wrote recently, quote, "The contenders for the Republican presidential nomination, with the glaring exception of the neo-isolationist Ron Paul, are on record as saying that if America attacks Iran, it will be first and foremost in order to save Israel," as Texas Governor Rick Perry framed it. As the flurry of anti-Israel tweets following last week's CNN debate showed, many Americans were taken aback at what could easily be portrayed as the subordination of American foreign policy to Israeli interests, and the predominance of the Israeli-Iran issue over such so-called minor foreign policy issues as China, the Arab Spring, or the Eurozone debt crisis, which weren't even mentioned, unquote. Well, I might seem to some that I'm hitting hard on Republicans, but the only reason for that emphasis has been because there's no comparable election process for Democrats. The Democratic nominee will be Barack Obama. But he's no better on the Israel issue than are Republicans. In fact, in the run-up to the election campaign in which Barack Obama became president, he went out of his way as well to pander to the Jewish lobby, to the major Zionist organizations, in securing his support for the presidency. In fact, one could say that Barack Obama is less supportive of Israel than even Ronald Reagan had been. President Obama has pledged, of course, to veto any Palestinian bid for United Nations recognition as a member state. Not long ago, he addressed an assembly, a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, and in his address was so blatantly, ardently supportive of Israeli interests and policies that his address earned praise from even hardline Zionists. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called Obama's speech, quote, "a badge of honor," unquote. The U.S. ambassador to Israel, appointed by Barack Obama, made clear not long ago that U.S. Middle East policy is driven by concern for Israel's security and identity as a Jewish ethno-religious state. The U.S. ambassador to Israel, Daniel Shapiro, said, and I'm quoting, "the test of every policy the administration develops in the Middle East is whether it is consistent with the goal of ensuring Israel's future as a secure Jewish democratic state. That is a commitment that runs as a common thread through our entire government." Now, that's worth really emphasizing. This is a statement by an official U.S. ambassador to Israel, appointed by Barack Obama, that the test of every policy the U.S. develops in the Middle East is whether it supports, it has the goal of ensuring Israel's future as a Jewish ethnic religious state. Again, that's something the United States does not make as a pledge to any other country in the world. It doesn't guarantee that Turkey will remain an ethnically Turkish state, or by doing so has the right, therefore, to oppress or discriminate against non-Turks within Turkey, just to give one example. But to support Israel as a Jewish state means also to support policies of discrimination against non-Jews within Israel. But again, it's worth stressing that this commitment, as Shapiro puts it, runs as a common thread through our entire government, the entire U.S. government. And that's indeed the case, because it runs as a common thread not only through our entire government, but through American political life. Now, it's worth keeping in mind that the policies and the positions of leading Republicans who blame Barack Obama for selling out Israel or a policy of appeasement are showing that they have broken from even the position of Ronald Reagan, who is regarded by most Republicans as their party's greatest leader in living memory. Reagan laid out a lengthy and carefully considered presentation of his views on the Israel-Palestine issue in a major address in September 1982, his so-called Reagan Plan for the Middle East. Now, in this speech, reflecting Reagan's policy, he said, "The United States will not support the use of any additional land for the purpose of settlements during the transition period. Indeed, the immediate adoption of a settlement freeze by Israel, more than any other action, could create the confidence needed for wider participation in these talks." Now, that's worth stressing, because Reagan calling for an end or a halt to Israeli settlements is a position that is now rejected by almost every leading Republican candidate for the presidency, Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, and so forth. And it's worth keeping in mind that Reagan's position was one that was in keeping with international law and with American policy for many, many years. In that address, Reagan also went on that the American effort for peace in the region, or the American plan, must be based on UN Security Council Resolution 242, which calls for the withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied in the June 1967 war. Reagan said, "We base our approach squarely on the principle that the Arab-Israeli conflict should be resolved through the negotiations involving an exchange of territory for peace. This exchange is enshrined in United Nations Security Council Resolution 242, which in turn is incorporated in all its parts in the Camp David Agreement. UN Resolution 242 remains wholly valid as the foundation stone of America's Middle East peace effort. It is the United States' position that, in return for peace, the withdrawal provision of Resolution 242 applies to all fronts, including the West Bank and Gaza." Now again, Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich are rejecting not only longstanding U.S. policy, but even the policy of the man whom most Republicans consider the most outstanding Republican in living memory. So the claims by Gingrich or Romney and others that Barack Obama's policies are somehow biased toward the Palestinians or are somehow hostile to Israel are so groundless that they can only be regarded as conscious falsehoods. If the Republican critics of Obama's Middle East policies, such as Bachman, Romney, Gingrich, are honest and consistent, they must reject the policy of President Reagan as similarly dangerous or naive or harmful to Israel. Now, what's going on in all of this is not any real concern by Gingrich or Romney or Bachman for Israel, much less for American interests. What these people want to do is to be elected president of the United States. They want success in politics. They're putting their political ambitions above every other consideration. And that's because the organized Jewish community has by far more political clout than any other single religious ethnic group in the United States. This has been abundantly confirmed by many people over the years. The Jerusalem Post has noted that what they called the far disproportionate to its size, the size of the community, Jewish leaders and U.S. officials acknowledge is the influence of American Jewry in politics in Washington, and so is the amount of money they contribute to election campaigns. One member of the influential conference of presidents of major Jewish organizations, and I'm quoting the Jerusalem Post, estimated Jews alone had contributed 50% of the funds for President Bill Clinton's 1996 reelection campaign. Some years ago, Mother Jones magazine compiled a listing of the 400 leading contributors to the U.S. national elections in the year 2000. Seven of the first 10 were Jewish, as were 12 of the top 20 and 125 of the top 250. In other words, of the leading 400 leading most important financial contributors to U.S. national elections, at least in that year, the majority came from a group that represents no more than 2 or 3% of the U.S. population. That alone should be an outrage to most Americans, that any group representing 2 or 3% of the population can wield that kind of disproportionate power and clout. This power and influence is especially dangerous, far more dangerous than if, say, Mormons or Scientologists or some other group were to have that kind of power, because in this case it means aligning the United States with a country, Israel, that means inevitably dragging the United States into dangerous conflicts in a region of the world where its interests should be not siding with Israel, but to ensure what's best for the United States and for the world. Now, the biggest single donor to American politicians over the years, in recent years, has been an Israeli billionaire and media mogul named Haim Saban. In January 2007, it was revealed that he had donated approximately $13 million to various U.S. political candidates. The New York Times, in an article, noted Saban's ardent devotion to the Jewish state. And here's what the New York Times wrote. He has since emerged as perhaps the most politically connected mogul in Hollywood, throwing his weight and money around Washington and increasingly the world, trying to influence all things Israeli. I'm a one-issue guy, and my issue is Israel, he said. Now, that's from the New York Times. It's estimated that approximately 50% of money to Democratic Party presidential candidates comes from Jews, and approximately 25%, one quarter of money to Republican Party presidential candidates, comes from Jews. That is from this group that represents no more than 2 or 3% of the American population. Now, one of the most important things to keep in mind is that this is not a new thing. This corruption of American political life has been going on for many years. In fact, it's so entrenched that many Americans simply take it for granted and accept it without understanding and or accepting or realizing just how harmful and dangerous this is for America. It gets the United States involved in wars and conflicts that are harmful to our interests and to the world, costs us billions and billions of dollars that otherwise could be used for the benefit of America and the world, and is and that the price America pays for its so-called special relationship with Israel is not only a high one over the years, it will get higher and higher in the years ahead. Now, I've talked about this before, but I want to stress again that what Romney and Gingrich and Obama and others are doing in supporting Israel is only an extension of what I call the original sin of U.S. Middle East policy, which was already in 1947, 1948, when the United States decided to support the so-called partition plan of Palestine and the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. The U.S. support in 1947 for Zionism and Zionist ambitions was already one that clearly separated those who were concerned about authentic U.S. interests on the one hand and the ambitions of American politicians on the other. At that time, the director of the State Department's Office of Near Eastern and African Affairs, Loy Henderson, who's one of the most renowned and revered American foreign policy officials over the years, he wrote a memo to the Secretary of State and warned, "Support by the government of the United States of a policy favoring the setting up of a Jewish state in Palestine would be contrary to the wishes of a large majority of the local inhabitants with respect to their form of government. Furthermore, it would have a strongly adverse effect upon American interests throughout the Near and Middle East." He went on, "At the present time, the United States has a moral prestige in the Near and Middle East unequaled by that of any other great power. We would lose that prestige and would be likely for many years to be considered as a betrayer of the high principles which we ourselves have enunciated during the period of the war." Support for a Jewish state in Palestine, Henderson also warned, and here's what he said, would guarantee that the Palestine problem would be permanent and still more complicated in the future. He said that, went on to say that proposals for partition and recognition of a Jewish state in Palestine, and he said this, are in definite contravention to various principles laid down in the UN Charter, as well as to principles on which American concepts of government are based. These proposals, for instance, ignore such principles as self-determination and majority rule. They recognize the principle of a theocratic racial state and even go so far in several instances as to discriminate on grounds of religion and race. Now, Henderson was not alone. He wrote that his views were those not only of the entire Near East division of the State Department, but shared, and here's what he said, by nearly every member of the Foreign Service or of the Department who has worked in any appreciable extent on Near Eastern problems. In 1947, the CIA reported that Zionist leadership was pursuing objectives that would endanger the strategic interests of the Western powers in the Near and Middle East. What's crucial is that President Harry Truman, who had to make the ultimate decision, ignored the advice of not only these men, but also his own Secretary of State, to put domestic political considerations above the national interest, above the interests of the world, and above the basic principle of justice. His own Secretary of State, George Marshall, was enraged that Truman was putting electoral considerations ahead of the national interest. He said that President Truman's support for Zionism, this is what Marshall said, would cause the great dignity of the office of president to be seriously diminished. And he wrote that by supporting Zionist ambitions, Truman was basing this on domestic political considerations, while the problems which confronted us was international. Marshall went so far as to say that if the president were to back Zionist ambitions with regard to Palestine, he would not vote for President Truman again in the election of 1948. This view is echoed by Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, who also tried unsuccessfully to oppose the Zionists. He was outraged that Truman's Middle East policy was based on what he called squalid political purposes. And he asserted that the United States policy, here's what he wrote, should be based on United States national interests and not on domestic political considerations. One of the most telling commentaries was made by Kermit Roosevelt, an important legendary U.S. intelligence agent who was also nephew of President Theodore Roosevelt. He noted, and I'm quoting, "The process by which Zionist Jews have been able to promote American support for the partition of Palestine demonstrates the vital need of a foreign policy based on national rather than partisan interests. Only when the national interests of the United States, in their highest terms, take precedence over all other considerations can a logical, far-seeing foreign policy be evolved. No American political leader has the right to compromise American interests to gain partisan votes. And he went on to predict, the present course of world crisis will increasingly force upon Americans the realization that their national interests and those of the proposed Jewish state in Palestine are going to conflict. It is to be hoped that the American Zionists and non-Zionists alike will come to grips with the realities of the problem. Unquote. Well, all of these predictions, all of these warnings have been vindicated by the events that have taken place. It's worth, again, repeating what Kermit Roosevelt wrote. No American leader has the right to compromise American interests to gain partisan votes. But that's the spectacle that these Republican candidates for president made of themselves on December 7th when they addressed this Jewish conference in Washington, D.C. They're putting partisan interests, their own ambitions, above the interests of America and of humanity and of basic justice. One of the consequences of this is that America around the world is looked upon, understandably, as a country that does not stand for any real principle, that is simply is a corrupt society, a corrupt government, one that cannot be relied upon to pursue any policy other than what's dictated by powerful interests within the United States. And that the leaders of the United States are men without principle, or in the case of Michelle Bachmann, women without principle. In the long term, this has disastrous consequences. And it's a reflection of the extent to which American political life has become this corrupt. Now, this is especially dangerous because the United States is committing itself to the interests and the agenda of a country whose prospects are not good. In other words, the United States is aligning itself with a country that's weak. It's going to have more difficulties as time goes on. Israel's long-term prospects are not good for no other reason than merely demographically. The Jewish population of Israel has reached a kind of plateau. It will increase slightly, but far more rapidly is the increase in the Palestinian and Arab population. That's just one thing. In fact, by the year 2040 or so, the population of the territory between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River will be a majority non-Jewish. Now, that's just one trend that's an important one that's working against long-term Jewish Zionist interests in that region. But there's others. Over a long period of time, there has been a fall in support for the United States and certainly for U.S. support for Israel in the entire region. And one of the most important aspects of this has been the shift by Turkey from its policy of alliance, or at least cooperation with Israel, to one of hostility toward Israel. In the 1950s, the United States had a network of alliances with many countries in the region. And although the U.S. still has military bases in countries surrounding Iran and in many areas, many parts of that region, the overall political stability or position of the United States has fallen tremendously. Former U.S. National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski has warned that if the United States carries out an attack against Iran or supports an Israeli attack against Iran, U.S. presence and position in the entire region will probably become impossible, and that a war against Iran will have support from nobody else around the world except from Israel. Europeans won't support it. China will not support it. Russia will not support it. It will be rightly regarded as a conflict that serves only Israeli Zionist interests and not the authentic interests even of the United States, much less the rest of the world. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. I hope you'll join me for future broadcasts.